James Rollins is the New York Times bestselling author of thrillers that have been translated in more than 40 languages. He's known for unveiling unseen worlds, scientific breakthroughs, and historical secrets. His knack for breakneck pacing and stunning originality have been hailed by critics and embraced by many, many readers around the world. His latest novel is a Sigma Force novel. It is entitled The Bone Labyrinth. It's published by William Morrow, and we welcome James Rollins to the roundtable this morning. James, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe.
What brought you to this particular work?
Well, you know, I'm always looking for a historical mystery, maybe a piece of history that ends in a question mark. I'm also then looking for a bit of science to play with, something that makes me go, what if, where that's head next? In this case, it was sort of one thing became both. It was an anthropological mystery, a bit of historical mystery, and scientific mystery. And that surrounds a moment in time known as the Great Leap Forward. And what that is that for about the past 200,000 years, our human brains really haven't changed much. They've been the same size, shape, anatomy. Yet 50,000 years ago, at that point in time, there was suddenly and inexplicably a great explosion of art, weapon development, the production of grave goods, civilization itself. And anthropologists don't know what triggered it. Why for 200,000 years our brains have been the same, but 50,000 years ago there was a sudden spike. It's baffled anthropologists and geneticists. They've tried to guess what, debated what's caused that. One of the most common accepted theories is that's about the same time that early man began to migrate out of Africa into Europe. They were being exposed to new lands, new challenges, and of course that required new innovations to deal with. But there's other debates about diet. It might have been the fact that a little ice age was going on during that period of time. There's no settled answer on what causes Great Leap Forward. And so there's a new theory that's being proposed right now, something that I incorporate into the pages of this novel, something that I expand upon a little bit. And I think it's exciting. I think it gives us an idea of not only who we were in the past, but maybe give us a hint of where we're headed next. Could we be headed towards another Great Leap Forward, and what might that look like?
The book begins in Croatia. Give us a sense of how you start this off.
Well, it starts out when two sisters, they're both geneticists, are attacked on two different continents. One of them is assaulted in Europe, in Croatia. She's out there investigating a medieval chapel, one that's found buried underground in a cavern system in the mountains outside of in Croatia. And in there, she discovers the entombed bones of a Neanderthal woman. And that begins one thrust of the story. On the other side, the other continent, another sister is attacked outside a research center outside of Atlanta. And she's abducted along with her research animal. He's a young sign language-speaking gorilla. And he also has a sort of unique genetic history himself. Sigma Force is called in to try to find out what happened to these two women. They expose a Chinese plot that's looking to genetically alter human embryos, something that sort of ripped from the headlines because it was just announced with about a year ago that Chinese scientists have been experimenting with human embryos. And so this sort of explores something that's sort of right at the cusp of where we're heading next in genetics and where that might lead to.
Talk a little bit about the idea behind the Sigma Force and how that became a series for you in the first place.
Sure. Well, Sigma Force itself is a group of special forces soldiers. They're recruited by DARPA and retrained in various scientific disciplines to work for the research and development wing of the Defense Department. They're basically field operatives for DARPA, or otherwise, as I described, they're scientists with guns. And I liked the idea. I introduced them in my first book, what I thought was going to be a standalone called Sandstorm, but I liked this group of characters, and I thought, you know, I was reluctant to begin a series initially because I what I call the Jessica Fletcher syndrome from Murder, She Wrote. You know, here's this old woman that's always stumbling over dead bodies.
Right.
I never stumbled over a dead body. Yeah, week after week, she does. And that begins to strain credibility after a while, unless, you know, the last episode of Murder, She Wrote should have been the revelation that Jessica Fletcher was a serial killer and she's been framing people all along. So, I just had this reluctance initially to do a series, but then when I created this sort of cast of characters, this group of characters, this ensemble, I thought I could build a series around a group because it gets me around that sort of Jessica Fletcher syndrome while also allowing me to put everybody at risk, because when you base a series on a group of characters, I can easily kill off a major character because DARPA can also always recruit another Sigma Force member. So I like the fact that everybody's in jeopardy, the threat can come from many different directions, and I also can swing my literary spotlight onto different characters in different books to explore them a little more deeply.
I assume nothing will happen with Joe Kowalski.
You know, Joe first appeared in one of my standalone novels, Once Upon a Time. The novel was Ice Hunt, but I liked him so much, his big lug of a character, not the brightest bulb necessarily, probably not the perfect fit for Sigma necessarily, but I liked him so much that I recruited him to Sigma anyways and added him to the series. But he's always been a sort of a supporting cast member. He's a lot of people's favorite characters, myself included, and I got sort of questions from readers saying, you know, hey, come, when are we going to learn more about Joe? You know, how does Joe tick?
Mm.
And I thought, well, you know, here's a book that deals with Neanderthals. This is a good time to swing that spotlight onto Joe and get an idea of how he ticks. So, you know, this is the first time where I write scenes from Joe's perspective. We get a little clue on how Kowalski thinks and ticks and where he's come from. And so it was a great deal of fun to write.
There is a comic relief aspect to this character.
He does. He's always been sort of like a support role for the team. He's good at blowing things up. He's, like I said, he's always a little bit of the comic relief for the story. But in this book, we find that there's more depth. There's more to Kowalski than that gorilla-like exterior is hiding.
All right, so let's get to one of the really cool parts of this book. At least I found this cool. So one of the layers of the story involves the perhaps little-known fact that Neil Armstrong, first man on the moon, led this expedition of the system of tunnels and caves in Ecuador and Peru in the 1970s.
Exactly. I mean, I'm always like the lovely little pieces of history that have that question mark. Of course, it's a little more modern history. But here, Neil Armstrong, first man to walk on the moon. When he returned, he became a bit of a recluse. He pulled away from the public spotlight. Disappeared for a bit. Yet later in life, about 7 years after he returned, he pops up and he's leading an archaeological expedition into the jungles of Ecuador, looking for a lost city, a city rumored to hold a vast secret library of gold tablets and crystal tablets. And it's a true thing. And what's even more startling is that though on that first expedition, they did discover some old tombs, but nothing particularly startling. You know, the gentleman who claimed to have known exactly where this crystal lost library is talked to Neil Armstrong and tried to get him to come back again, and Neil Armstrong was convinced enough from conversing with this gentleman to proceed or agree to go on a second expedition. Yet 1 week before this expedition was led, this gentleman who knew where this lost city was located was assassinated outside his home. So it's just one of those things that just raises an eyebrow, makes you wonder, you know, is there something hidden out in that jungle?
Do you find yourself collecting those moments, those odd little fact moments?
I do. I've always got my antenna up. As a matter of fact, just a couple weeks ago, I counted the number of magazines I subscribed to. I subscribed to 36 different magazines. And I'm always looking for that bit of history, that bit of science, and you know, get a little X-Acto knife if there's an article, I cut it out. If I'm watching National Geographic or Discovery Channel, if something comes up that interests me, I jot a note down. If I talk to somebody, if I'm traveling, I'll make a note, add to the box. It's messy, it's convoluted, I like the messiness of the box, and I have to sift through it every now and again to get rid of old ideas, because I don't want one box to become two boxes, to become four boxes, and so James Rollins on Hoarders. You want to keep it in one box. But there's a bit of magic in that, and that oftentimes that bit of science, that bit of history will either end up in my hand at the same time or on the floor at the same time. I'll begin to see how maybe those things connect. I'll explore it, do some research. Sometimes I find out, no, I'm wrong, they don't connect. Other times it begins to snowball, and I begin to see the story build, and then I'm ready to go.
And it must be, and I obviously work, but it must also be fun to try to connect those facts in a way that works and is satisfying for both you and for the reader.
Yeah, it's almost like playing with a jigsaw puzzle. You know, got all these pieces, and then you have to try to find out where things fit without trying to make it feel like you're forcing it in there. So it's a great deal of fun. One of the aspects of my research I love to do is I like to travel. I don't necessarily travel for research per se. I don't say I'm going to set a story in Paris, so I'm going to fly to Paris, run around Paris, and come back and write about it. I usually just travel for the fun of it. I jot notes, take pictures, I journal. I also love to ask people questions. I'll walk up to people and ask them, you know, tell me something nobody knows about this town. Tell me a secret. And it's surprising what you'll find when you ask that question. I did this when I was traveling in China. Again, wasn't traveling for research purposes. I was just traveling just to travel. And I spent a week in Beijing, a week in Shanghai, and a week in Hong Kong. And I walked up to a gentleman in Beijing and asked him that question, telling me something that nobody knows about this place. He told me something quite startling. He told me, well, what most people don't know is that buried underneath Beijing is an entire underground city. It was built during the Soviet era. It's the width and breadth of the city. It extends out into the mountains so that if the Russians ever attack, the entire population of Beijing can recede underground. That still exists. It's crumbled into a bit of ruin since that time. Some areas have collapsed, but it still is in existence. As a matter of fact, that's how the Chinese government was able to hide troop movements during the Tiananmen Square crackdown. They even rolled tanks through this underground city to bring them into position, to keep them from eyes above. And so, again, it's little details like that that I wouldn't have discovered if I hadn't walked up to somebody and said, tell me a secret.
Well, the name of the new novel is The Bone Labyrinth. It is published by William Morrow. James Rollins, a great pleasure. Thank you very much for joining us. Best of luck with the novel.
Thank you, Joe. Appreciate it.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, James Rollins' new novel is The Bone Labyrinth. It is published by William Morrow. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.